At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Good evening. Welcome back to the second hour of Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis sitting across the board from me, and all the way from London, England, sitting in studio with us this evening, international news correspondent Adrian Lee. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Dave.
I wish you all the best of New Year's this year. I hope you guys have a good time. Be safe out there if you're listening. Don't drink and drive. Be safe. Get a ride home. Have somebody come with you that's a designated driver. I worry a lot this time of year about my people out there, Adrian.
You're very philanthropic.
Philanthropic? Take it back. That sounds dirty when you say it.
I can say it again if you want me to.
No, please. We've got to get to our guest. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us for the first time on Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, Robert M. Place. He's an internationally known visionary artist, author, and illustrator whose award-winning works in painting, sculpture, and jewelry have been displayed in galleries and museums in America, Europe, and Japan. He's graced the covers and pages of numerous books and publications. He's the designer, illustrator, and co-author of The Alchemical Tarot and The Angel's Tarot. He is a designer, illustrator, and author of The Tarot of the Saints, The Buddha Tarot, The Vampire Tarot, and he's the author of The Tarot, History, Symbolism, and Divination, which Booklist has said may be the best book ever written on the deck of cards decorated with mysterious images called The Tarot. And he is the author of Astrology and Divination and Shamanism, which are part of the Mysteries, Legends, and Unexplained Phenomena series published by Facts on File. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Place. We appreciate having you here this evening.
Thank you.
I've got the information. Now, first of all, I'll lay the word for us here. What is it? Tarot? Tarot? What's the correct pronunciation on this?
Well, you know, there's various pronunciations. I always try to allow people to have their variations, you know, because basically pronunciation is something that changes from region to region, but generally in dictionaries it says tarot.
All right, tarot.
But you could go tarot. It doesn't matter as long as you don't pronounce the final T.
All right. Now I'm curious with this because this is something that's interested me. We've had tarot readers in the studio before to do live readings on air, and everybody seems to come from a different point of view. I'm really interested in you talking to us a little bit, first of all, about kind of the history of divination and the use of tarot cards. Can you break that down for us? How did these come in, and at what point in history did this become a useful tool?
There's a lot of misinformation about the tarot, so a large part of my work is straightening out just the very things you're talking about,
right,
about the tarot. The tarot, you know, it really comes from the 1400s in Renaissance Italy. There weren't any tarot decks before the early 1400s. It probably developed sometime between 1410 and 1430. And the most likely places are either Milan, Ferrara, or Bologna, which are all in northern Italy.
Now, was there anything in particular about, you know, this being a form, and with the research that you've done on this, I know there's so many different tools that have been used, from tea leaves to bones to dice to different things like that. What made cards come about? Do you know? I mean, was there
cards were always used for divination along with playing card games, and there really wasn't any distinction. Like the oldest books we have that show, definitely prove that cards were used for divination are actually from Germany, and they were books that were written in the 1480s. And they were just using regular four-suit decks, you know. See, what the tarot is simply a deck of cards that was developed by adding an additional fifth suit to the four-suit deck.
Okay.
So, you know, like, if you play a regular game of cards, now you have four suits. You know, there's hearts and diamonds, clubs and spades, right?
Right.
Now, those are French suit symbols that came about in the late 1400s. And but the oldest decks in Europe have the same suit symbols you find in the tarot. They're the four suit decks were, you know, they had stabs or clubs and swords and cups and coins, you know, that's what the occultists, like with the Wade Smith deck, changed the coins to pentacles and the staff to wands to make them into the tools of the magician, which of course they, you know, fit quite nicely. But originally, you know, it's just coins and staves. And it seems like those suits were actually based on an Egyptian deck called the Mumluk deck, which the only difference was that, you know, the swords would curve and look like scimitars, and the sticks were really polo sticks originally. So that deck was introduced into Europe through Spain and possibly Sicily sometime in the 1300s. You know, it's very hard to determine the exact time, but we know by 1336 we have definite evidence that those decks existed, because we find in Bern, Switzerland, there's laws, you know, that prohibit gambling. And these law books don't mention card games before 1376, so that's the first mention of a card game in any of these laws. So a lot of the evidence, you know, like, you know, you'll see over and over again, people in books will say, well, no one really knows the origin of the tarot. But,
right.
I mean, we don't know the exact origin of almost anything, you know. But we can pin down through the facts, through both positive and negative facts, when something happened. And we have a really good idea how something happened. And things don't just pop into existence usually fully formed. They sort of evolve. So the Islamic cultures through Spain and Sicily introduced paper making and card games sometime in the 1300s. And by the early 1400s, we start seeing games where they have a fifth suit that acts as trumps. And these are the ancestors of the game of bridge. But in bridge, you know, when you play with a four-suit deck, you're actually assigning one of the four suits as trumps. But these are decks that have a natural trump suit. And trump, of course, is a word we borrowed from French as trom, which originally in Italian was trionfi. And what a trionfi is a type of parade in which, you know, it started in ancient Rome when, like, the general would come in. And the theoretical structure of a trionfi is that the figures of lesser importance are introduced first, and then each new character that's introduced trumps the one before. So they keep becoming more and more important as the parade goes on. And then this was revived in the late Middle Ages in Italy. And by the Renaissance, there were triumphies all the time. Every major city had them almost every year, or for special events, for weddings, to celebrate victories. I mean, basically, the Mardi Gras is a continuation of this practice. You know how, like, in the Mardi Gras parade, it's a tremendous parade with all kinds of symbolic figures.
Right, no doubt.
Lots of mythology connected to it. So this is the kind of thing that was going on. And basically, these cards originally were called trionfi cards in Italian, or carte dei trionfi. And what the fifth suit was really a triumph, one of these parades. And now the parades had entered into...
Was there a specific reason for... I mean, when you have cards like the Hanging Man and the you know, Angel of Death and the different card characters that came up, is there a specific reasoning behind those? Designs.
Once you understand that the tarot was a product of Renaissance Italy, and you look at each of these individual figures and compare them to Renaissance art, which is what I've been doing, you'll see that all those same images exist in Renaissance art, and we know the meaning of them, and by comparing these images and other works of art and determining the meaning, it helps us determine the meaning of the tarot cards in the first place, what they're originally meant to mean. But the structure as a parade is really important, because what you're having is a mystical story, and it's very much related to how the trionfi was used in Italian art, particularly in poetry and in the visual arts, where, you know, like, I Trionfi was a famous poem by Petrarch, who was one of the first Renaissance writers, you know, along with Dante. And he wrote this poem that had a mystical structure, and then it had six triumphs, six characters that each trumped the one before.
Right.
And it started with love, which was really, you know, it was really more of an image of lust being conquered by virtue, and then virtue is conquered by death, but then death is conquered by fame that outlives death, but fame is conquered by time, because fame fades in time, and then the final triumph was eternity, which is this mystical symbol of the last judgment and you know, God coming, and what, you know, the thing that is beyond time, beyond death, you know, the eternal life everlasting in the afterlife.
How do you believe that, you know, I mean, I understand that people have a need to try to seek answers outside of their own realm. And so many people turned away from religious aspects to seek answers. Where did, you know, do you follow a path of things that go from tea leaves to bones to dice to cards in the certain method? I mean, is there a certain specific way to do this? Or, I mean, how do we go from throwing bones on the ground and understanding the meaning of the way they lay to drinking your tea?
It's an interesting question. I just wrote this book just last year called, for the Mysteries and Legends and Unexplained Phenomena series called Astrology and Divination, where I covered all these different forms of divination. And you know, they, like, scholars divide into three groups. Like, there's intuitive divination, inductive divination, interpretive divination. But it seems to me that no matter what type of divination you're doing, what's happening is divination, the root is of the word is divine. In other words, what you're doing is you're talking to the spirits, the gods, you know, or God himself, depending on your religious beliefs. So, like divination in ancient Greece was the evidence that the gods existed, because when people went to the Oracle of Delphi, Apollo himself was talking to them. You know, so it was like, sure, a direct conversation with Apollo. It was like something it like verified their religious beliefs for them. And we sort of have, you know, we sort of belittle divination as just foretelling the future, which is more like just fortune-telling.
Mm-hmm.
But divination doesn't really mean that. It means having a conversation with a wise spiritual entity, which, you know, I look at as the higher self.
Now, when you say higher self, do you mean that's some type of esoteric, ethereal creature you're tapping into? Or is it your own psychic or your own your own personality, just knowing these things and seeking the answer from within?
Well, I like to use, you know, I come to it from a Jungian reference. So I'm trying to, you know, basically Jung would just say the self.
Right.
But I think it's just clearer if I say the higher self.
Okay.
Because, you know, if I say the self, it's a confusing word, and then I have to explain it's a Jungian term, and I mean the self with a capital S and all. So I just say the higher self, people get it right away, that it's something outside of just their normal ego.
All right, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll discuss more on this.
Okay.
Our guest is Robert M. Place. We'll be back with more and discussions of divination in the Tarot right here on Darkness Radio. Good evening. Welcome back to Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Across the board from me, Tim Dennis, and international news correspondent Adrian Lee, live in studio this evening. Our guest is Robert Place. Mr. Place, before I went to break, we were discussing the Tarot, and our international news correspondent is in the studio with us. Was also a bit of a historian and such, and would like to, he had a question he'd like to direct to you real quick.
Oh, sure.
Hi, Robert. Yeah, one of the things I was interested in is the early Renaissance that you said the symbolism for the tarot cards came from is based on depicting biblical stories on church walls. Because obviously the idea being that the peasants come in, you know, to the church, they're uneducated, there's no books in that period. And this was a way
repeat that?
Sorry, my accent's probably thrown you a bit. The early Renaissance...
It's also coming across the phone, you know.
Sure, not a problem. The early Renaissance is based on biblical images on church walls. And I was just wondering how we got to the tarot, which is obviously moving away from Christianity and towards the occult, yet it's taking its symbolism from biblical images.
Okay, right there. I think that's a misnomer.
Okay.
Because the thing is, in the 1400s, In Renaissance Italy, I think it's difficult for us to get into their consciousness. Basically, this is a period that labeled itself. They called themselves the Renaissance. Of course, the label didn't really come about to, like, you know, in the early 1500s. But the thing is, the reason they felt it was a Renaissance is because they were reclaiming their classical heritage, and they and were struggling as hard as they could to reclaim all these beautiful pre-Christian ideas, mystical ideas. You know, they looked at Plato as a mystic, not just, you know, we tend to look at Plato as a, you know, a rationalist philosopher, whereas, like, to them, it was very obvious that he was mystical. And they were reclaiming these mystical ideas from the past and synthesizing that with their Christian heritage. They didn't see a separation. Like, one of the main Renaissance Neoplatonists, Ficino, Marsilio Ficino, you know, was a priest. And yet he was a Neoplatonist, and he's the one who translated Plato, and he translated the Hermetic material and Plotinus and all the Neoplatonic material. And he totally wanted to synthesize all that with Christianity. And he was a famous astrologer. You know, he wrote a lot about astrology, and he didn't see that as conflicting at all with his Christian beliefs. So the thing is, a lot of what we call a cult today wasn't necessarily a cult originally. In other words, astrology was an accepted part of Renaissance thinking and alchemy and things like that. Were just, you know, they were moving from these things into science, but we're at, in the 1400s, at a point where there's both sides are accepted. So there's a merging and a synthesizing going on, and Christianity isn't necessarily at odds with these things. They're trying to make a synthesis where they started looking at, they were interested in Hermes Trismegistus because they felt that Hermes, they saw this philosophy that combined Plato, the mystical aspects of Plato, with the teachings of Christ, and they felt that it just showed that these teachings had a common source in a wisdom tradition that went back further, because they believed that, you know, they didn't realize that the Hermetic material was really written after Plato and Christ. They thought it was much earlier, you know, back to the time of Moses. And so you'll see, like, for instance, in the Siena Cathedral, on the floor where they show all the great philosophers and thinkers going back to Christ and then go back to pre-Christian thinkers, the first figure they show is Hermes Trismegistus, the mythical author of the Hermetic material. So this, and yet we consider this stuff a cult, but to them it wasn't anti-Christian, it was totally synthesized, you know, it was an accepted part of their culture. And when they put these ideas in the tarot cards, the ideas are coming directly from the arts and poetry that, you know, I mean, the similar figures were made in sculptures that were in reliefs in villas, or they were made in garden sculptures. They were enacted in the actual parades that people watched. You know, these are all familiar characters. It's just like today, if we have a parade today at Christmas time, we see, you know, there'll be a float with a sleigh and pulled by reindeers and a fat man in a red suit, and nobody has to tell you what his name is. Everybody knows. Well, all these characters in the tarot cards in the 1400s were like that. They were characters that were part of their popular culture that everybody knew. They knew the hangman was a traitor because that's what he was. You know, to be hung by the foot was a symbol of being a traitor. They didn't have to puzzle over it the way cultists did later and make up other meanings. They knew what the meaning was. It was just part of their popular culture. They knew the figure, you know, like we all know the figure of justice because we see her on top of the courthouse, and of course that she's in the tarot cards, but they also have a woman pouring water from one pitcher to another, which represents temperance. And see, that's not so familiar today, but to them it was just as familiar as justice. These are all we're all parts of the common culture.
Could you explain to us, you mentioned that there are three forms of divination that you mentioned. Could you especially for our newer listeners who are just getting this?
Divination seems to me the most direct and obvious, and that comes from, the primary form is dream interpretation. Or having a vision, which is, like, you know, very much connected to religious experiences and shamanism and things like that. Then inductive divination is where you actually look for the communication. It doesn't, you see, like in a dream, it just comes to you. You go to sleep and you always have a dream, and you either remember it or you don't. But when you're remembering it, then, you know, you're getting this communication. And it's interesting because Jung, you know, in his dream work, always feels that the real dream maker is the self, which is what I'm calling the higher self. So you can see that the message is coming from our higher self through our dreams. It's a natural communication that happens every night to everyone, and this is the basis of all divination. Now, in inductive divination, we're looking for the message. We're looking for oracles, and this is how astrology developed, by looking to the sky for messages from the gods, because all ancient people believed that the gods wanted to talk to them. They knew deep intuitively, certainly, that the gods existed, depending on the religion, or God existed, and that there a communication was going to happen, and they knew it because they saw it in their dreams every night. And this is exactly how shamans find out they're shamans, because their dreams tell them. Now the third type, interpretive divination, is where you actually give yourself a pattern. Like you throw sticks or bones, and you interpret them. You know, the I Ching comes out of this, right? Now, the tarot cards are really fascinating to me because they're obviously, they come out of an interpretive divination where you're giving yourself patterns and interpreting them. But because they have a series of mystical pictures that come right out of the unconscious that are archetypal, they're actually making a bridge between interpretive and intuitive. It's like giving yourself a waking dream, which is what I always tell my students.
All right, now, for the people that are using divination tools like the Tarot, You know, a lot of the people that we speak to claim that it's their spirit guides that are guiding the cards and releasing the information.
Sure, I could see that.
Do you believe it's your spirit guides or the spirit guides of the person who you're reading for that are influencing the cards?
I mean, what we get into is we get bogged down in terminology. Like, you know, when somebody's saying their spirit guide, what mm-hmm. are they really talking about? They're talking about archetypal personality, right? And it seems to me that, like, you know, coming from a Jungian perspective, there's many, many archetypes that are all actually aspects of the self, because the self is the totality of all the archetypes. So when I say the higher self, all I'm saying is I'm trying to get back to what's underneath all these archetypes or spirit guides or, you know, whatever. But the, but you know, you could, it could come to you as a spirit guide. It's okay. You know, it's like, I'm not going to dictate to people the way the spirit should come to them. I just want them to find it, you know.
Right.
So if that's the way they're finding it, great.
When you're tapping into this, how much of when you're doing tarot reading, though, is your ability, and how do you know that you're not switching off your ability to just read people and understand the human psyche?
Well, because the cards are the safety net. And as I look at the cards, and well, first of all, in my technique, when I teach people to use the cards, I teach them not to try to predict the future, because I think it's sort of, I don't think it's a very valuable thing to do with the cards. If the, you know, I mean, not that I think it's impossible to predict the future, because I've seen it happen in my dreams over and over, but it just happens in your dreams, and trying to make it happen seems like there's a philosophical problem with that. And I think it's more useful to use the cards to get in touch with intuitive information about the present, to understand other people, to understand relationships, to make decisions about what you're going to do. And this is the most useful thing, because just making a prediction can be fatalistic and pointless. You know, it's like, something bad's going to happen to you tomorrow, so what do I do about it, you know? Like, where it's going to be much better to say, look, I think this would be a good choice for you to do today, and not even talk about bad things happening tomorrow, you know?
I know a lot of people are fatalists, so they'll ask, you know, am I going to die? Is, you know, my marriage failing?
Right away, don't even... That's not a question we want to deal with the cards, because that's why people have fear about the tarot, because first of all, they're expecting, they go to a tarot reader and they're predicting the future, and they're worried about something bad being predicted. But I put the fear aside right away, because what I do is I give people advice. So you come to me, it's a safe place. The cards are always telling you things to help you out. They're there to help make you healthier, to help you make better decisions, to make wiser decisions coming from the higher self, which is the wisest part of our personality. And what I do is I never put down one card to mean anything. And I always put them together in groups of three, because when you understand where they came from, they're a type of symbolic picture developed in the Renaissance that was called a hieroglyph, which was basically their attempt to sort of create something like Egyptian hieroglyphs. And that these are meant to go together in groups to communicate.
Okay. So when you're doing one card, you're only... revealing.
Yeah, you have one hieroglyph.
Right, you're only one part of the story. Okay.
And you have a story. Or, you know, at least a sentence or something. You know?
Sure, right.
Okay, so, you know, so, but then when I started, when I hit on this, you know, it was my own higher self told me this through doing the readings, and then my intuition led into this process. So, you know, it's like I was, you know, I tell people I sought to read the cards by the higher self. The cards taught me themselves. So, I noticed, looking into this, that there's seven different patterns that happen. Like, you know, there's, like, you could have...
Well, let's cover that. My producer signaling me we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about those seven patterns.
Okay, sure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Darkness Radio with our guest, Robert M. Place. We'll be back with more. Welcome back to Darkness Radio on your home for Paranormal Talk Radio every Saturday and Sunday night, 9 to midnight. Hey, Tim.
Hey, what?
A zombie attack is bringing chaos to Harvardville Airport.
Ooh.
Leon Kennedy and Claire Redfield, who fought the sinister Umbrella Corporation during the Raccoon City tragedy 7 years ago,
yep,
they're back. In a high-octane Resident Evil style, they're ready to battle a rogue warrior who's seeking revenge after his family was killed in Raccoon City. The new deadly G-virus is unleashed, and a new mutated monster goes on the rampage. Will Claire and Leon be able to terminate the virus before history repeats itself?
I don't know, Dave, but that's what dreams are made of.
That is what dreams are made of. And if you want the answer to that question, get the new Resident Evil Degeneration movie. It's out. It's a CG, fully animated movie in the Resident Evil theme. Great. It is not a follow-up to the three live-action films. This is more like a sequel almost to the original Resident Evil video game. And it is a full-on movie. It's great. I really enjoyed it. Watched it, did a review on it in last night's show. We've got, I think, five or six copies to give away. Six copies to give away. So I'm going to give it away. We're going to do one right now on a trivia question. And write this phone number down. First one to call in and correctly identify this answer will win a copy of Resident Evil Degeneration. What classic cult horror movie was originally named Night of the Flesh Eaters? Again, the original name was Night of the Flesh Eaters. If you know that answer, call now. And you'll win a copy of Resident Evil Degeneration, the brand new CG animated movie. We're going to go back to our guest, Robert M. Place is joining us here, and we're talking about the Tarot. You said before we went to break, Robert, that there were seven different patterns, and could you go over those with us?
Yeah, and these are basic patterns that I've noticed that the cards could do based on the way the figures are facing on the cards. You know, either they're looking to the left, they're looking to the right, they're looking at you. You know, sometimes their body's going one way, their head's turning another.
But let me ask you real quick while you're mentioning that. When you're doing the cards and you flip them, does it matter if the character's upside down?
Oh, I never use upside down cards.
Okay, so what do you mean? If it comes up upside down, you toss it and do out a new card, or you just don't read it as though it's upside down, you just
I just make sure they're all right side up.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, see, the reason people would use upside down cards is they're trying to get more vocabulary out of the cards. But if you know, it's because, you know, you only have 7-8 cards in the deck, and this way you're sort of doubling your vocabulary. But, you know, there's 456,456 possibilities of three cards. So it's, you know, sort of like, you know, if I had four, I'd have a huge, even more, you know, it's like, be like a DNA strand.
Right.
So you're making, you know, you're making a huge vocabulary all of a sudden.
Okay.
So you don't need the upside down cards, because and I just find upside down cards confusing.
All right.
You know, especially as an art. I mean, maybe it's because I'm an artist and I design the decks. I don't want people turning them upside down. You know.
Right. Okay. So now go back in. I'm sorry, with the seven different.
Okay. So the thing is, like, you know, you depending on how they're facing, they all could be just going left to right, right to left in a row, which would be sort of linear. Or they could be, you could have two characters coming, like, going away from each other, sort of turning their back on each other. So, like, the center card, which would be the most important, the action of the story, could be turning its back on one side and going towards the other. You could have it face-to-face, like a meeting happening. Or the energy, you know, the center card could sort of be looking at you and the end card's moving away from it. So this action starts in the center and goes to either side. Or the opposite, it could be coming from the two sides into the center, because the center is looking at you, but the outside ones are facing into it, you know. But the center one could also actually be blocking the energy, which, you know, that was something, you know, because all these were watching the energy pattern. Is it going left to right, right to left? If it's meeting something, going away from something, it's coming in the center, coming out of the center. But then I realized that if the center was a card where it's really blocking energy, it could be like that it is expressing, you know, energy that's stuck. And then the final one was the center card could become like a teacher showing us two polarities, like either or. And polarities are always important in any of these readings. You want to look at how, you know, the cards change from one side to the other. So that's basically the seven patterns that I teach people. And mm-hmm. then you know, sometimes the reading could be not, you know, could be sort of a combination of two of the patterns even. You know, not necessarily just purely one of the seven patterns, but that gives us a base. It's sort of like learning the scale when you learn music, you know.
Adrian, you had a follow-up question you wanted to ask Mr. Place?
Yeah, I've heard tarot readers in the past say that it's not possible for them to do a reading on themselves. Do you think that's a possibility? Do you do readings
for
yourself?
I always read for myself.
Yeah.
And I teach to read for yourself. I think tarot readers coming up with this idea that you can't read for yourself is pretty self-serving, don't you? It's like, oh, yes, you must hire me, you know.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. But does that, again, you're saying that it's a catch-all because you're relying on the cards then, and you're not relying on your ego or id to be answering your questions.
Correct? Yeah, because once we're looking for this pattern that's in the cards, and then the pattern's definitely there. The cards are either saying, yes, it's all going to left, or it's leaving something behind and going away from it, or it's going towards something. So we have that before we even look at what the pictures are saying.
So do you
and then
do
we
do
plug
you
plug in what the pictures are saying with that pattern? We're already getting away from our ego.
Do you ask specific questions whether you're doing the reading for you or having it done? I mean, is there, you know, should I change this job?
Basic pattern. Like, the thing is, one of the most popular readings I do is called a relationship reading, where I have three cards on the left representing the querent or myself, and the three cards on the right representing some other person or thing that's in a relationship with the querent. And then three cards on top representing a bridge between the two. And we read, and you can, and so not only then do we read each group as one of the seven patterns in the three-card reading, but we want to look at how the three cards that represent the querent are moving toward or away from the other three cards. So just looking at the direction of the cards already, I know something. And sometimes, and I can even feel the energy in the cards. You know, sometimes I'll just run my hand over and feel the energy flowing.
Well, now you've got all these different sets of cards, from the vampire deck to the angels deck to the, you know, what is each deck? I mean, how are they different if they're basically the same type of characters, or do you, how do you change that around?
Well, what I wanted to do, my work is, I wanted to find, first of all, I asked the question, what did the people who first created these cards, what were they thinking, what did they mean? Because I found that mostly the cultist ideas seemed like a denial of the pictures. You know, when you start saying they're the letters of the Hebrew alphabet or they're astrological signs, this simply isn't true. These pictures aren't those things. So I've come to this as an artist and an art historian, and I could clearly see that this, you know, this material wasn't from that. There's nothing Jewish about them. They're not about Hebrew letters. Those Hebrew letters mean things in the Kabbalah, and these cards don't picture those things that they mean. And that's where the astrological connections come out of, the connections with the Hebrew letters, and those astrological connections aren't in these cards, because if they were, they'd be clear. You know, the things that are very clearly astrological are like the sun and the moon, you know, or the star card, which just say, oh, this is the star card. It means the star, you know, and it means the stars. So the Renaissance art is much more, you know, above board. It's not some secret code, and I think people start to get too hung up in looking for a secret code instead of just looking at the pictures in front of their face. So the first thing I want to do is actually look at these pictures, where they come from, understand the history behind them, and then I want to take that and understanding the story and seeing how what's there is really this mystical story of the hero's journey, which is an archetypal story, seeing how it relates to other things. And what I really like, see, the first deck I designed was called the Alchemical Tarot. And what I noticed is so many of these images related to images in alchemical art, which, of course, you know, alchemy came through Italy in the 1300s, you know, well before the Tarot was there. And alchemy relied very strongly on these same kind of hieroglyphs and became part of the common vocabulary by the 1400s when they developed in tarot cards. So alchemical images definitely were influencing these images. And so by understanding that connection, And then seeing how they related to the alchemical images, I found that the trumps basically told the story of the alchemical great work of how to find the philosopher's stone. So it was the same message. And then, see, that was really important to me, because then it hooked in, like the whole message was the same. Now, after that, I was trying to come up with other ideas. And my publishers at HarperCollins wanted me to do Rosemary and I, who worked on the Alchemical Tarot, wanted us to do an angel tarot, because angels were very popular back then. And, you know, this came out in 1995 when angels were everywhere. You know, everything was about angels.
Right.
So, you couldn't go to a mall, and every store in the mall had angels in the windows, even if they were selling shoes, you know. So.
I totally remember that, because I'm an angel collector and have been since I was young.
Yeah, and then
it just exploded. Yeah, exactly. It was everywhere.
Yeah, okay. So they made us do an angel tarot, and it gave us a ridiculous short amount of time to do it. So what I tried to do is I tried to find angels that fit all those archetypes that were in the tarot, but I didn't have a central story. You know, I liked it better when I did the alchemical story, because not only did I find alchemical images that related to the cards, but I found that the trumps told the alchemical story, the great work of finding the Philosopher's Stone. But now I didn't have that central story. And then Llewellyn asked me to do a saint's tarot, and I sort of did the same thing and found saints that fit. But I didn't have the central story, and I was really missing that. So then I started working on my own ideas, and I realized, it dawned on me that the story of Buddha, you know, Siddhartha becoming enlightened, becoming the Buddha, was the same story that was in the tarot cards, even though obviously that's not what anybody was thinking about in the 1400s, but because the story is that archetypal hero's journey, it fit perfectly. And all the standard icons in Mahayana Buddhism were related directly to the tarot cards. And this blew everybody's mind because nobody had seen this before. You know, they're trying to make, you know, like loosely connecting Buddhist ideas sometimes to the tarot, but nothing like this. It was so direct. And not only that, but once, you know, once Buddha became enlightened, because he became one with the world, and the world was symbolized as a mandala, which has a sacred center in mm-hmm. four directions, he actually became the five jhanas, which are represented the sacred center in the four directions, and each jhana is a different color, and they each have a shakti, which is their female partner, and they have a protective animal, and they...
So
and
that
they
let itself really well for this time, yeah.
Yeah, so there was a, you know, it was a tarot deck. I mean, sure. It was like, you know, it was all the kings and queens and knights and the page, right?
And we have to take one more break here, and then we'll be back for the top of the hour. So stick with us, Mr. Play. Sorry, we'll be right back with more for you. We'll be back with more. Just keep listening to Darkness Radio. Good evening. Welcome back to Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Resident Evil Degeneration is a brand new movie, CG animation movie in the Resident Evil vein. It's an awesome flick. If you're interested, just came out on December 27th. You can buy it at any major video seller. We're giving away copies tonight. First person that can call in and correctly answer this question will win a copy of Resident Evil Degeneration, the full-length animated feature. Call us in at first person that can quickly call in and identify the five of the dead movies that George Romero is associated with. And there's only five that he did that are part of his brand. I want to know the name of each one. They don't even have to be in order. Look at that. The phone's ringing. I didn't even get the question out already. They're getting us. So if you've got the answer, call in. We'll get you a copy. And Henry from Hampton was the winner of our last one. And the movie, of course, Night of the Flesh Eaters, was turned into Night of the Living Dead. The backers thought it maybe sounded a little less gratuitous doing it that way. We're going to go back to our guest, Robert in Place, and we're discussing the Tarot. And you had another question for him, Adrian?
Yeah, I was just wondering, having designed all of these packs, what your favorite card was?
My favorite card.
Yeah.
Well, Visa and MasterCard when they're paying to buy his decks. Is that right?
I don't think I have a favorite card. I will say that the star card in the Alchemical Tarot was the first card I designed for that deck, so that has a special meaning to me. And it was the first one to be published because it was in an article in Gnosis magazine that I wrote. So it's sort of, I guess, you know, the star from the Alchemical Tarot is pretty special to me. But, you know, like I was explaining before, like, it's really about the story, you know, like I was thinking about how the story of Buddha was really the same as the Trumps. And see, that, and then recently, of course, I just finished the Vampire Tarot, which I think a lot of people thought was a big stretch for me, you know, because when I did, you know, I did the angels and the saints, and everybody's saying, oh, yeah, that Catholic, you know, guy who does tarot decks, you know, and thought they had me pegged. Then I did the Buddha tarot, and I went, maybe he's a Buddhist, you know. And then
can I commission you to do a Dukes of Hazzard tarot deck for me? I think that's going to be a big seller with the Pop Kitsch group. What do you think?
I don't know. Maybe.
Let me ask you, Robert.
You have to find 78 characters from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Sure you can, man. You got names like Cooter and Enos.
Could. If anybody could, I could.
Yeah, exactly.
But see, the thing is, with the Vampire Tarot, I used the story of Dracula, which unified the deck, because Dracula really is the same story. It's Bram Stoker was familiar with the tarot. He was good friends with Pamela Coleman Smith, who designed the famous Wade Smith deck, and you know, he knew all these people in the Golden Dawn, and he actually based characters in Dracula on tarot cards. You know, that's what.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, that's the opinion of his main biographer, Barbara Bedford, I believe it is. And, but I also see there's a lot of references to, like, the Grail legend and things like that. And that is very much part of the mythology that influenced the Tarot in the first place. So it was really interesting to me to come up with a story that actually fit about vampires that was really fit the tarot and really makes sense. And it's the story of Dracula. I think it's, you know, and most people, of course, don't know the whole story very well because they know it from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of movie variations that change it all the time.
Exactly.
But, you know, I went back, of course, to the book, you know.
We should do the one of the trivia questions tonight be, who is it that actually killed Dracula in the book? Because everybody always assumes it's Van Helsing.
I might add as well,
you don't want me to give the answer then, though.
No, go ahead, because we won't do that one tonight, but I always think it's funny that people always assume it was Van Helsing that killed Dracula.
Well actually, Van Helsing, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Arthur, Holmwood is, you know, is sort of, he's a noble, and he sort of has this band of friends that come around him that were like knights, and so he's obviously, you know, as a noble and named Arthur, he's obviously the King Arthur figure, and they even call their band of heroes his knights in the book, and then of course Van Helsing is more like the Merlin character, the magician, right?
Right.
So the main knights that go, so it's the knights that have to go out and kill Dracula, and the main two knights are Quincy, who's actually a cowboy from Texas,
right,
and using a Bowie knife, and Jonathan Harker, who's using a kukri, which interesting, you know, is interesting because in it was featured in the last of the three Resident Evil movies, which I heard you plugging before.
That's right.
You know, the what's her name? The main character was using two,
Alice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. Kukri to decapitate the zombies, you know. So, you know, it's like this big, it's sort of a curved hacking knife for cutting off heads.
Right.
So Jonathan has the kukri, which of course comes from India, and Quincy has the Bowie knife, which comes from Texas. And and it's interesting because it's parallel, because he stabs him in the heart. He stabs Dracula in the heart with the Bowie knife while Jonathan is slicing Dracula's throat and cutting his head off.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I love about it, is that, you know, it's a cowboy that shoots him, you know? And why wouldn't they leave that in the movie version? That's kind of cool...
Well, it is in there's been a couple of movies where it is, but the closest movie version is Bram Stoker's Dracula that was done by Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
And it actually is the only movie that has all the characters, including Quincy.
Well, we've got
but,
about...
Quincy's in another movie version, but then they left somebody else out. But mostly, Quincy's probably the most often left out character, though, because people just couldn't deal with a cowboy. What's a cowboy doing in this story?
We've got about 2 minutes left. What can you tell people that you'd like them to know about the Tarot? And, you know, how can you give some advice to people that if they're going to go for readings, that they get the most for their readings?
Okay, well, first of all, as I said, I don't think the best use of the card is predicting the future. I think predicting the future should be left to your dreams or just psychic visions. And I think the main reason you want to use the Tarot is to get in touch with the wisdom that's inside everybody that I call the higher self. And that's what divination is all about. So what you want is you want advice about what to do in your life, how to make decisions. You want to use the Tarot cards to help you make the best decisions, to make the best choices, to help you to empathize with people and understand other people. And always working for making the world a better place, making your life better, you know, making yourself happier and healthier.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Place. I appreciate you joining us. Your websites, why don't you give out the website addresses so people can visit you there?
Yeah, well, there's two websites. There's alchemicaltarot.com and thealchemicalegg.com.
Right. And both of those web links are up on our site. If you go to Darkness Radio, click on the upcoming shows, you'll find Robert M. Place, and there's two links there to join him. Thank you very much for joining us, shedding some light on Tarot and giving us the answers. I appreciate it, and hopefully we can have you back more in the future as we're going forward.
Sure. Well, once the Vampire Tarot is out this summer, I believe, I'd like to come back.
Oh, I'd love to have you back out for that. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
All right, thank you. And hey, you guys, stay tuned because we got some more great stuff coming up after the top of the hour. We have Brenda from Shasta Lake, California, is the winner. The question, of course, was what are the five of the dead movies that George Romero did? You have Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, and The Horrible Diary of the Dead. That one broke my heart, Tim. I'm such a George Romero fan.
And the upcoming Shower with the Dead, so that ought to be
fun. Yes, that's going to be good. Actually, he does have another one coming out. So, but we've also got, coming up at the top of the next hour, Robbie Thomas, the psychic, is going to be joining us for a segment on 2009 predictions. Tim, Dave, and Adrian are going to be sharing their predictions with you as well. Hilarity is bound to ensue. Don't you agree, Mr. Dennis?
I don't know about hilarity, but something will.
Oh, man.
Well, I'm going to be funny. I can't, you know.
Yeah, you can't speak for all of us. Yeah. I understand that. And we're going to give away another copy of the movie Resident Evil, The Generation. Suddenly I'm the Swedish chef. We're going to be back with more. We'll give away another copy of Resident Evil Degeneration in the next hour. So stay with us. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio on 100.3 K-Talk.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.